our guest here in the studio, been with us before many times, Jim Kaler. He is now Emeritus Professor of Astronomy at U of I. I do like saying that. I know. You said like...
Oh, yeah, it sounds good.
You like saying that, don't you? Well, yeah. Well, and it's not every...
Sounds snooty.
Everybody doesn't get to be an Emeritus Professor. Well, I know you're not a snooty guy. Of all the words I would use to describe you, snooty would not be one of them. He is not a snooty guy, ladies and gentlemen. And for a long time now, has been here every once in a while to talk about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. And of course, it always changes. It's always different.
I bet you'd even let people drag a big bag of cash into the lobby.
I would.
I bet you would.
We'd even help them. We'd help them unload the cash at curbside.
Good luck. This is a wonderful resource. And I drive around the country, and I've never found anything like this. You listen to other PBS stations, and you get mixed up with music and talk, and everything's all mixed up. And here we've got them. Got the best of all worlds.
Well,
I love this station.
We're really lucky that we have the two stations so that we don't have to, because we think both of those are good things, music and talk, but we don't have to try to put them on one station. There are a few others across the country where they have to, but most public stations are FM stations, and they have to do a little bit of both. So we're really lucky. Well, what we do, generally here, is when you stop by, is first have you talk a little bit about.
We have a beautiful evening sky going on right now. You can see the bright planets. Venus, you can't miss. I mean, it's impossible. I'm getting calls on it. I get emails. What is that big bright thing that I've never seen before, except it's been around for the last 4.5 billion years? It's really quite bright, and it's especially well positioned this summer. The ecliptic, the path of the planets and the sun is almost vertical. In the evening, and it lofts these things way up high. Venus is not setting till after 10:30 or so at night, and it's up a good part of the night as you approach midnight and finally sets. And up very close to it right now is Mars. The two are approaching. They won't quite come in a conjunction, but they're close. Mars is quite a bit fainter, but you just look up a little bit to the left of Venus, and there's Mars. And over in the sort of the east or to the south, depending on what time of night you look, is Jupiter, which is the second brightest thing. It's hard to miss that one, too. And in between is Saturn. So you just look at it, just speckled with bright stars and planets, and it's just a beautiful evening sky. If you've got a little telescope or even binoculars, take a look at Venus. Venus is goes through phases like the moon. Because it's between us and the sun, and you don't see the full sunlit face, and it's entering a crescent phase right now, and it's quite attractive. You can't see any features on it because it's just clouds, but it's still a pretty thing to see. The planet's approaching us now. It'll get bigger and bigger in appearance and brighter. It will continue to brighten until May 2nd when it reaches the greatest brilliancy for this turn, and it's quite the amazing sight. If you're out in the country, and you've got a really clear night, get away from artificial lights and you see Venus casting a shadow. It's that bright.
That bright,
yeah, it's
really
that bright. It's an eerie sight because unlike solar shadows, Venus is a point source rather than an extended disk, and the shadows are sharp and crisp. They're subtle, but they're quite visible. But you've got to get away from all artificial lighting and moonlight to see that. But the little disk is quite readily visible. And even with binoculars on Jupiter, you can see its satellites. You have to hold them very carefully and very steadily, but you can see little points of light next to it. The rings of Saturn take a little more power. You got to get a telescope up to 40 power or so before you can actually see them reasonably well. But if you got a little telescope, take a look. They're very, very attractive sights. It's just a wonderful evening sky.
Yeah. Venus really is stunning. It's so bright.
You can see it in the daytime. If you got a really clear blue sky, there it is, this little speck of light going across the sky. It's the only thing you can see readily in the daytime other than the sun and the moon. Yeah.
So I guess it's not surprising that among ancient observers of the sky, that was a thing that they figured was pretty important.
Yeah, there are some cultures have even based calendars on it, long-term calendars. Venus has a curious orbital pattern relative to the Earth. Every 8 years it repeats itself. This is 2004. So if you look in 2012, try to remember this, everybody. You look at 2012 on this date, you'll see Venus almost exactly where it is right now. Mm-hmm. It's a coincidence, I think. Nobody has quite figured out whether it's any kind of a gravitational pattern or what. Probably not. But
I was just
a curious coincidence.
Reading an article the other day about Venus, and it contained some comments by a man who is a planetary scientist whose name is David Grinspoon, who's been here on the show. And it was interesting because he apparently was talking at some sort of scientific meeting or a conference about the idea, the possibility that there might be life on Venus. And he's essentially, he was saying, you know, yes, maybe a long shot, but you shouldn't completely rule
it out.
No,
he's right. He's quite well respected, by the way. He's right. Since we have no clue where we're going to find life, you better not poo-poo it anywhere. The conditions are weird, but then again, you know, you got life forms living in almost boiling hot springs. We found life in rock a mile down at the bottom of the ocean. It's just everywhere. So, no, I mean, you can at least look. Getting there is half the fun. It's a dreadful place with huge temperatures and noxious atmosphere and noxious clouds. The old Soviets sent several packages to it to land on the surface, and they survived for about half an hour under those conditions. But it's a pretty bleak-looking landscape, just rocks as far, flat rock as far as you can see.
Yeah.
Not a pleasant place at all.
I think his supposition was that it might be possible that there would be some kind of microbial life form could survive in the clouds.
You can't deny it. I mean, it's impossible without actually going to look. That's what science is all about, after all. You go look. You don't make up your mind in advance.
And the other thing that struck me was that apparently the feeling is that at one time there was liquid water on the surface of the planet.
Of Venus?
Of Venus.
I don't think that's clear. It's been suggested. I've seen the suggestions that possibly there was an ocean at one point, and it would actually make sense, but there's no direct evidence for anything like that. I think we haven't done the investigations at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have caller. Why don't we talk with them in Indiana on our toll-free line? Hello.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, it's too bad we got these clouds. I've been checking out. It's always get every kid I can and say, you want to see the planets? At least, you know, pretty.
Oh, as good as, nice and clear here last night.
What was it, a year ago? We see all of them that were visible. At one
yeah, point. It happens every once in a while. They all sort of cluster on one side of the sky, and you just get yourself a beautiful view.
And my question's a little more difficult, I think. I'd like for you to, if you can, make some comments about the loss of the nice telescope up above us for determining, you know, some of the important questions in regard to cosmology. This will set us back. Are there other ways to solve these problems, or exactly what?
Well, it's a unique telescope. There's nothing like it. It's not a big one. It's modest by ground-based standards, but it's in the world's best observing site by far, above the atmosphere, where you can make use of all the fine optics of the instrument. It has been an astonishing telescope in terms of bringing research results to the scientists and in terms of bringing the fascination of the heavens to the public. They've done a beautiful job with that. And I think the loss is going to be tragic. There's all kinds of political overtones to this that I'd rather not get into here, but I don't think I don't know an astronomer anywhere who is for this, for dumping the Hubble. I think there's a terrific push on, both by my professional society and by various others, to keep the thing up there. Seminars going on to try to round up support for it, and I'm hoping that NASA will reverse itself. Mm. The telescope has a lot of potential for a long lifetime. The next generation space telescope will be launched sometime, at least contiguously with the Hubble going down or being lost within a few year span. But the next telescope up there is not a general-purpose instrument, and it can't be serviced. It goes up. It's going to be much farther away from the Earth, and it's been optimized for infrared to observe really for cosmological problems, which is a lot of what the Hubble was meant to do. It turned out, however, that although the Hubble has done terrific work in the distant universe and cosmology, we discovered it was terrific for a lot of other things too, including planetary science. It's been an amazing telescope, and I'm just terribly sad to see this decision and to see that telescope go. Mm.
Well, apparently there is a move also in Congress. There are some members
yes.
who
yeah.
would at least what they're pushing for is a review of the NASA decision, not to continue to maintain the telescope. So there apparently is also within Congress some base of support for the idea
of support in Congress
of continuing.
That the telescope has paid for itself. It's an expensive one, sure, but it's paid for itself many times over with the programs that it's had, both for scientific use and for public use. Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's my understanding that basically the issue is that NASA says, well, look, we've only got so much money. We have this major commitment to the space station. So what we're going to do is we're going to put everything in that.
Yeah. I probably best not get into that. I have some extremely strong opinions about it. But the space station, which is, I suppose, fine if you've got the money for it, but it's competing with a scientific instrument, which the space station isn't.
Yeah. And I know that people who are astronomers, I'm sure, who do that kind of work are interested in all of the things that you can do with various kinds of telescopes and probes and
the Hubble did not replace ground based astronomy. It enhances it. They complement each other. We've got telescopes on the ground which are vastly larger than the Hubble that do other things and do them very, very well. And there's a terrific amount of overlap. But what the Hubble's got going for it is resolution, resolution, resolution. It's like, if there's one thing you want in astronomy, it's the ability to resolve detail. And because of the twinkling of stars, the Earth's turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere, it is very difficult to do that from the ground. Right. There are ways of overcoming it technologically, but nothing better than getting above the atmosphere in the first place. Yeah.
So even if you made up a computer program that would process the image, it's not as good as what you can get if you're actually above.
Well, computer processing isn't going to do you any good anyway, because you've got a disturbed image by the time you get the image. You can a little bit of massaging, but you can't really do much of it. What you have to do is process the stream of light coming into your telescope before you take the image, and that can be done with systems that are called adaptive optic systems, in which you are in effect flexing the telescope mirror to offset the twinkling of the star, because that causes the star to shift its position. So you shift the telescope mirror a little bit, and you can detwinkle starlight that way. But they're doing very well with it. We have a major program here at the U of I in adaptive optics, and there are a number of them around the country, but they have their limitations.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at U of I. And as here occasionally, we talk about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. If you have questions about astronomy, about space exploration, I know he'd be interested in maybe take his best shot at answering your question. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So one way or the other, whether you're local here or it would be a long-distance call, if you have a question, you can call us. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Minor addition to the decision to retire the Hubble telescope, and I'm pretty opposed to that. I think that it's worth the risk. But the logic isn't necessarily money. The issue is that they're worried when the space shuttle goes back again that if they ever have another problem with tiles, if they're at the space station, they have a place to go until they can be rescued or take the Soyuz down. If they go to the Hubble, its orbit is so far from the space station. If they go to the Hubble and they have a problem, there is no way to get those astronauts
back. That's quite true. And it's a valid point.
And the astronauts, on the other hand, said we're willing to take that chance to keep the Hubble going, and God bless them.
Well, it's one thing to say we're willing, you and I are willing to take the chance, but we're not the ones that are actually doing it. The astronauts have got to be the ones that are willing to do it.
Several of the astronauts have said they're willing to take that chance. The problem is, I think, that NASA doesn't have a shuttle to replace it.
Could be.
They probably can't replace it anyway.
Yeah, it's a complex issue. They're going to have to visit it anyway somehow to bring it down. They can't let it come down by itself. So now we're looking at robotic replacements to put a rocket on it so that they can stall the thing and bring it down into the ocean.
It doesn't have enough thrusters on it to do it itself?
No.
I was unaware of that.
So they've got a problem that way. You've got a problem no matter what. You can't just let that thing deorbit all by itself. It could wind up in the middle of the quad. Well, no, it can't. It's too far north, but you get the idea.
Oh, no, in the middle of the quad.
But thanks for the commentary. You're right. This is a complex issue.
Thank you, Doctor.
All right, thank you. And again, other comments, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Also, we do have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Well, I've been looking forward to you stopping by here because I've been wanting to ask you about Sedna. There was a lot of coverage of this back in, I guess it was in March, about what now is the farthest, and you correct me if I had this wrong, it's the farthest out object we have yet observed in our solar system.
In situ, in place, right. I mean, we know of objects that go out farther than that, long-period comets, for example. We see them when they're in their inner solar system. We know they're going out there, but we haven't seen them in place out there. Okay. There's a big difference. It's an extension of the disk of our planetary system. The first discovery of this extended disk was Pluto. Which turns the disk itself has been called the Kuiper Belt. It's a disk. The smaller bodies in it are nascent comets that, if they get close to the sun, will make what we call comets in the sky. Several years ago, we started to find other smaller objects that sort of shared the orbit of Pluto, and now there was a feeling that we've come to the end of this Kuiper Belt at about 55 times the distance of the Earth from the sun, and here pops up Sedna, which is. Goes out farther than that. Point is that we're still trying to get the census of the solar system. Mm-hmm. And nobody really knows how far out this belt extends and what kind of objects are out there and how they got there in the first place. How much gravitational interactions among the planets have tossed things out there, how much were formed out there. This is all just really a process of discovery. And it's likely to go on for a very long time.
And this was observed with a ground-based telescope.
Yeah, sure. It's not that faint. It's easy to pick up.
So why hadn't we noticed this before?
Not enough time, I guess. The technologies continue to get better, and you have to go out and look for them with your new technologies. The real revolution was with the charge couple device, which came in a decade or two ago, which totally replaced photographic plates. Photography would not work with this really well at all. You need electronic detectors, really what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But it's a big sky out there. It takes a long time to search it. And then you look deeper and deeper, farther and farther off the plane of the solar system, farther away, and you start picking things up. It's really a matter of search and discovery, mm-hmm. and takes time.
We are going to take time right now to take a little time out of the discussion. We'll talk some more with Jim Kaler in just a second. But we want to take some time to encourage people to financially support this radio station. We couldn't do what we do without the financial support of all those folks that we call the friends of WILL, which is now regrettably kind of a small percentage of the listenership. And what we would like to try to do is encourage people who listen, who'd say, yeah, Focus 580 and Afternoon Magazine and All Things Considered Morning Edition and maybe many other programs, they're a regular part of my life. I rely on the fact that I'm going to go there and I'm going to turn on the radio and the show is going to be there. Well, folks, you just can't take it for granted. You can't assume that somebody else is going to help pay the bills. If you rely on us to be here to do the show when you turn the radio on, we rely on you to help pay the bills. If you have done it already, well, we want to say thanks. If not, and you've just been thinking about it, we say, why wait? No time like the present. Go to the telephone and give us a call, 244-9455. That is the number to call to make a pledge. Here now, slipping into the studio as Jack Brighton, producer emeritus, Focus 580.
I love that title. Thank you.
He gave himself that title.
Yeah, I couldn't give myself a raise. So
he gave himself a title. Producer emeritus, and also he's currently our director of Internet operations. So he's the guy who's responsible for the website and doing that sort of new form of technology.
That's right. We make all the archives appear, for example, on the website. Every show that airs here on Focus 580 is also archived on our website, so you can go back and listen anytime you want.
Every show?
Every single darn show.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay.
Almost got in trouble with the FCC there. We want to let you know that right now, if you call before 10 o'clock, if you have never pledged before or if you're returning to us, Your name will add to the list of folks who will help us earn an additional $250 before noon today. Make a pledge. Join the Friends of WILL by calling 244-9455, and that will add $250 to our pledge total. And that is a challenge to you from a longtime listener of Focus 580 who really wants to support the show and the station, and has pledged to increase his contribution, double it, in fact, this year, if we hear by noon from 10 new members of WILL. So please do make that call. There have been several people who have responded to that, and one of whom is Paul Slater in Bloomington, Illinois. I wanted to mention Paul in particular because he is a new member, has never contributed to WILL before, but is also a member of the Bloomington, Illinois public radio station. So that's pretty good. That's double duty. What a fine citizen, I would say. So join Paul Slater. Thank you very much, by the way. And call us right now, 244-9455, with your pledge. There's one other thing I wanted to say. We are blessed. We are so lucky here to have an AM and FM station, obviously, and a TV station here, and such fine support from listeners. We're also very lucky to have people like Jim Kaler here at the University of Illinois who come in and give us their time pretty much any time, you know, that we ask that he can make it, of course, because he believes in this thing, public education, the thing that we do on the air is talk about a lot of issues, whether it's, you know, political, social issues, economic issues, or science. One thing we do spend a lot of time on the show is talking about science, and we think that's something that we ought to do, and we hope that you will help us support that. Again, 217-244-9455 with your contribution.
All right. Thank you, Jack. And if you have questions for our guest, Jim Kaler, call in the number, regular number, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to Sedna for a moment or two.
It's cold. You're not going to like it.
Well, I guess. I think I read something about how, what was it, the daytime, the warmest it ever gets was 400 degrees Fahrenheit.
Minus 400.
That
actually sounds a little high.
33 actually. Kelvin. Yeah, okay. -400.
Yeah,
Fahrenheit.
33 Kelvin's up there because I think. Well, that's about what Pluto is, give or take a little bit. Doesn't make too much difference once you get that far out.
Yeah. So no, I'm not going to go there. My question was, what does something have to be, or how big does something have to be before we would call it a planet?
You ask 20 people that, you get 20 answers. It seems to be a terribly important question for a lot of people, where what is a planet is really cultural more than anything else. A planet is what we have always called planets over the last century or so, and we haven't really redefined it. Therefore, if you like, you can say Pluto is a planet because we've been calling it a planet since 1930, and why not? What the heck? It's the biggest body. It's also a Kuiper Belt object. It's the biggest body of the Kuiper Belt. So why can't it be both? Doesn't have to be one or the other. You can hear various definitions. I like to call a moon a planet. That gives us 10, if you like. I mean, looks like a planet, acts like a planet. It just goes around us, but we go around it too. So why not call the moon a planet too? So you can get 8, 9, or 10, depending on how you want to look at it. And if you want to toss in a big asteroid, that's okay too. Cirrus is round. One of the definitions that people use is that it's spherical, that it's big enough to have enough gravity so that it squashes it into a spherical shape. And then you could add a few asteroids yourself. And the whole thing gets hopelessly complicated with overlapping definitions. So it's better to just go, I think, for my part, go with the cultural definitions. We always called them planets, the traditional nine ones. Why not keep calling them that?
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess that was in some of the reporting on this, some of the stories sort of said was, you know, used to be there were 9 in the solar system, and now we're going to say that there are 10. And
I wouldn't put that body like that. It's clearly a Kuiper Belt or an extended Kuiper Belt object. It's maybe the next biggest after Pluto, but there isn't even a good diameter measurement of it, and it's very comparable to the unpronounceable Hohar, whatever its name is, which was discovered a couple of years ago, which could be number 2 as well. And you just waste your energy trying to define things like this when it's simply not necessary.
Q-U-A-O-A-R?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think so.
Quaor or something like that. It was the creation god of the indigenous people of the what is now the L.A. Basin, I think. It's kind of hard to start coming up with names.
Sedna was named after an Inuit goddess.
Yeah, right?
Who lives at the bottom of the sea. Another cold
place. And it's cold up there, too.
Exactly.
That's right.
We have someone on a cell phone. Let's talk with them here at line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I was actually curious about, I heard the guest refer to the twinkle of a star earlier, and I was under the impression that only planets appear to twinkle in the sky. So I was just wondering if you could respond to that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, you got that wrong way around.
Sure, it's the other way around. Stars twinkle and planets don't, and that's not even true. Planets do twinkle, they just don't twinkle as much as stars. The twinkling is caused, it's from a naked eye point of view, it's really variations in brightness, not position. And the cause are cells in the Earth's atmosphere that act like kind of ratty lenses that can make a star look a little brighter for a time, a little fainter for a time, and shift the position. You see this especially when you look through a telescope. It gives a jittery look to it. Planets don't twinkle as much, and the reason is that stars are effectively points. You don't see the disk of a star when you look through a telescope. They're just so darn far away. Whereas a planet is, even though you can't see that with the naked eye, it's a disk. And if you look at each point on the planet's disk, it'll twinkle as much as a star. But they're out of phase with each other. So as a little point on a planet brightens, another little point on it will fade, and they tend to average themselves out, so planets don't twinkle as much. You will see planets twinkle when they get a little bit closer to the horizon. It's just not as great, that's all. The twinkling is always greater as you approach the horizon because you're looking through a greater thickness of atmosphere, which will promote the twinkling. The least twinkling is always overhead at the zenith. And you can look at Venus. It usually stares down with a pretty steady light. But every once in a while, you'll see a little flicker. You know, it'll just like, hey, you know, I can do this too.
But generally speaking, that's the way you tell which you're looking at, a planet
If you don't know the sky. If you know the sky, then you know where they all are anyway, and you know them by appearance. Because planets just, well, they appear where, if you know your background stars, and then the planets are there, they stand out like a sore thumb. Jupiter is now in Leo, and if you know the pattern of Leo, and there's this oddball there, you know it's a planet. Yeah. And Jupiter's always about the same brightness, and you learn. And color, you pretty much know what it is.
Okay. And right now, as we said at the beginning of the program, that next to the moon, the next brightest thing in the sky is going to be?
Is Venus.
Venus.
Yeah. Jupiter is normally number four, except when Mars is particularly close, where it was last year, then Mars can barely top Jupiter. So the two tend to trade off. But Jupiter is variation in distance between us and on Jupiter is not very much, so the brightness doesn't change very much either. Mars changes wildly. Now it's fairly—it's not dim, but it's vastly dimmer than it was when it hit its closest approach.
And that
year.
Was just because of the distance between
us and the planet.
Us and the planet.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you one more thing about Sedna, just because I know one of the things that astronomers were interested in was, based upon its movement, they theorized that it would have a moon. They expected there to be one, and at least so far,
I don't know why.
Seen it.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure. There's a lot of speculation when something like this is discovered. People bounce around with all kinds of interesting ideas, and eventually one or two of them will filter out when the observations get good enough. Yeah. Why it was expected to have a moon, I honestly don't know. I was surprised at that too.
Yeah. I guess it had something to do with the speed of rotation.
Oh, okay. Then it would have been in a Pluto is like this with its moon. It's in a synchronous rotation with, I think, a 6-day period. So if you have a long period, then you would expect to have a moon around it, but the periods could be short. Stars do the same thing. They will rotate synchronously with companions. Keep one face pointed toward it and rotate at the same rate at which it revolves. Our moon does the same thing. That's why you only see one face of it. You can never see the backside.
Well, I guess that would make sense because the speculation was, well, just because we haven't seen it, that doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't one. It's just possible that when we took the pictures, well, either that or it could have been in bag.
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons for it. And then, of course, it may not have one anyway. So
yeah.
Who knows? Always better and better observation. They'll be looking at this thing off and on and try to get a better picture of it. And I would think also looking for more. We simply do not yet have a full census of this planetary system. We don't know how far out this disk extends. Other stars have disks that extend quite a bit farther than our own planetary disk. And who knows? It's the only way you know, speculation is useless. You need to go out and look.
Mm. So, but we're figuring that there are objects of a similar size to Quarar and
could well be. We just don't know.
All right. Let's see. We have someone here to talk with in Washington, line number 4 on our toll-free line. Hello.
What I'd like to know is they have a flying infrared observatory, and I was wondering how high up does twinkling go? That is, I know it goes to mountaintops and to the big the plane down in Chile where it's really good, but if you could get up to 40 or 50 or 60,000 feet, would the twinkling essentially go away?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that. I would say yes. Certainly at 100,000 feet, I would think it would pretty much disappear, but I really don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to it. The twinkling is much less on high mountaintops, as you pointed out. The best observing site on the planet is Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which is, I think, at about 13,000 feet. And that cuts the twinkling quite a lot. You can really, and it's more than altitude, too. It also depends upon airflow. Get Ed Kieser in here. He could probably talk to us about that. Quite a number of resources are on this place, aren't there? But I that's an interesting question. I kind of like to know the answer to that myself. There have been airplane observatories. They've been used primarily in the infrared where it's not bothered that much by twinkling anyway. There was an observatory stuck in an old Boeing 707, and now we're building one into a 747. You can imagine a 747 with a very large hole cut into the side, open to the air, flying at 40,000 feet. Interesting. The FAA is looking at this very carefully, as you can imagine. But those are infrared observatories, and the twinkling in the infrared is much less than it is in the optical.
May I ask one more question?
Sure. Sure.
Also, why do they use airplanes rather than very high-altitude balloons for big infrared telescopes?
I think it's because, first of all, you can get the airplane up and down a lot easier than you get a balloon up and down. You can also put people in the airplane to run it. It's dangerous to fly in a high-altitude balloon for a human being. You can also, I think stability is probably considerably greater. You're not being blown around. You can stabilize the aircraft, or I think it's much more difficult. I'm sort of winging this, to stabilize the balloon. Balloons are used. They're very definitely used, but I think you get a lot more production out of a manned aircraft than you would out of a balloon.
So probably just in the airplane, you can have a lot bigger payload, a lot bigger instrument.
Yeah, and you can say you can bring it up and down a lot easier. I mean, you can land the thing in an hour and get it up to altitude in an hour, too. So you fly the airplane in a particular direction in which you want the telescope to point, and the telescope moves up and down, and you at 40,000 feet, things are 42,000, where that's the mission is called Sophia, and where it's going to fly, it's pretty darn stable. You can control these things very well. The old Kuiper Observatory, which has now been decommissioned, was just a marvel of one discovery after the other in the infrared.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Let's go to another caller here in Georgetown, Illinois, on line 1. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I observed something really bright in the western sky last night about 9 o'clock. Do our satellites have, do we see something?
That's Venus.
Was that Venus?
That was Venus.
It was so close.
Yeah.
It was very,
it
very
fools
close.
People into thinking it's a UFO. It's so close. UFO because the eye brain, if you're not used to seeing things like this, the eye brain combination will look. You look at that and you say it's big. It's not bright. It's big, and it's right next door, and it's going to land in the neighbor's yard, and so on. You know, and you know the thing's millions of miles away. It's just that it's impossible to judge distance once you get beyond a few tens of feet or so. But yeah, that's Venus that you're looking at.
I just
there.
Didn't think that could be a planet because, like you said, it looked like I could almost reach up and touch it.
Exactly, exactly. You just climb up a little bit higher and pluck it down. But no, it's a goodly distance away. It's a brilliant, brilliant object. It's wonderful to see.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, thanks. Yes, it's really beautiful. You can, as we said,
it's no question why it's called Venus. You know, Aphrodite, the goddess of love and beauty. It is just a wonderful thing to see.
Yeah. All right. We have somebody else here on our toll-free line, and we'll go there. Line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, enjoying your show.
Yeah, great.
I got a question. I don't know if you can give me an answer that a layman can understand.
No, we'll give you one. We may not be right, but we'll give you one. How's that?
That's good. This Einstein satellite they're talking about sending up, I don't know if it made it today or not, to measure the space-time warp around the Earth.
Yeah.
Can you give me some idea how they're going to do that? If the space-time is warped, what frame of reference can you use to...
I don't know very much about that. I'll be perfectly honest. They're using very precisely milled steel balls in this thing that will be affected by the gravitational effect of the Earth and the so-called frame dragging, which is the rotating Earth's, I think, if I get this right, pulling the fabric of space-time gradually around with it. Technically, how this works, I do not know. The idea goes back quite a while, and they've been trying to fly this thing off and on for years and years and years, and they finally got the budget to do it. It's yet one more experiment to either support or contradict relativity, and if it contradicts a little bit, then, of course, you can push ahead to bigger and better and greater theories, and maybe you'll also find that Einstein was everything we've done so far, and there have been countless experiments have supported what Mr. Einstein had to say. But I can't be any more. I'm sorry, I can't be any more technical than that.
Well, I imagine it is. I assume it'd have to be something to do with time.
It's apparently an engineering marvel.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Well, we hope, it's going to, I think, be in orbit for quite a while before it'll get any results. And all experiments like this are always wonderful to do because you never know where the next discovery or the next theoretical discovery is going to come from. You can trace the need for relativity actually back to similar gravitational influences, and it was our inability to replicate the orbit of Mercury
that
ultimately didn't. I wouldn't say it led to it, but it was the first actual
demonstration
that something was wrong with Newton's theory of gravity.
Yeah, and then Einstein's he was just applied to it and straightened it all out.
Bang on the money. It was excellent.
Yeah, isn't something like gravitational lensing, isn't this pretty much related?
Yes, and it demonstrates the bending of space-time by a gravitational field. If you get one body behind another, astronomically, this wouldn't happen with somebody standing in back of a friend of yours or anything. But if you get one star in back, exactly in back of another, where it's really seen is one galaxy, very distant galaxy in back of a nearby one, the very distant one is actually lensed. It's brightened. It can come out in really weird shapes, multiple and everything else. This was discovered first, I think it goes back 30 or 40 years now when we first made observations like this, and it's been a terrific support of relativity. In fact, curiously, this gravitational lensing has actually been used as a practical telescope to look at a natural telescope to look at ultra-distant objects.
Yeah, I've seen some of the Hubble photographs.
Oh, some of it's just remarkable. Yeah,
it's like arcs of light around.
You can actually see some of these amateur astronomers have even picked this up.
Really?
Yeah, with big amateur instruments, you can actually see it with the eye through the telescope.
Oh, you're kidding!
No,
oh my goodness,
it's rare. You have to know what you're doing, and have to have a really, really, really fairly good sized telescope. But it's amazing what some of the amateurs have. Some of this, I've seen amateur telescopes up to 24, 36 inches across. They drag around in trucks.
I wouldn't have thought that it would even be big enough to see something like that. But I understand, like, if you see the light around the galaxy or the lensing, it looks like arcs.
Yeah, sometimes it depends upon the positioning of the distant galaxy relative to the nearby one.
But then scientists can go ahead and do calculations and reproduce what that has to look.
Yes, that's right. And you can use it also to measure the amount of matter in the distance, in the space between us and the distant lensed source, which is yet another demonstration of this so-called dark matter, which has gravitational properties but has never been seen.
Yeah, and then we got dark energy.
Well, we got that now, too.
It's just getting,
life is just getting more and more complex.
Yeah, I know. My stomach starts to hurt when I think about all this. It's not making much sense anymore.
Well, it's always been that way in a way. You know, that's what science does. It goes out and examines the unknown, and the unknown is always mysterious. And I have no idea if when and if we'll ever really get to the bottom of all of this.
I'm kind of like David Inch when he says he keeps trying to understand quantum mechanics and from a layman's standpoint, and he just can't visualize it.
Yeah,
I thought it was pretty good until I found out the universe was accelerating. It's kind of like throwing a ball up in the air and
yeah,
it's
nobody
never
knows
back
what,
down again.
Yeah, and there have been people who are also looking into variations from gravitational theory that maybe this is causing the problem. This is not accepted, but there have been all kinds of ideas floating around. They're all welcome because you never know where your next good one's going to come from.
It's too bad we can't live it long enough to really know all the answers.
Oh, well, yeah, I suppose. But
we still
know
have
a lot
have
more
mystery
than we did 40 years ago when I got to this joint.
Yeah, but we keep them coming up with more questions.
Oh, yeah, that's the nature of the game.
Yeah, that's all part of it.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
All right. We have about maybe 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at U of I. Occasionally stops by here on the program and we talk about...
Yeah, just having me walking past and just wandering.
That's right. He just
wanted.
Well, and I must say, you know, Jim's lately been very patient with us because we kept scheduling and rescheduling. I think we about 10 times we moved the show. So he was very nice. Every time he said, "Okay, can you come Tuesday? Fine. Can you come Thursday? Fine. Can you come next week? Fine." So he was always very nice about it. So we kept moving him around. Maybe just to finish up, I thought we might talk a little bit about Mars and about some of what has come back now from the rovers. And I guess as I understand it, the very most basic thing that they were interested in was the question, was there ever water, liquid water on Mars?
I gather, I'm hardly a planetary expert, but I gather what they're finding is demonstrating, as was suspected for a long time, that there was standing water. I mean, you look at even the old Mariner pictures from the 60s. They demonstrated standing or at least running water at that point in time. Running water is different. You can get it to run for a little while without evaporating away. Standing water is very different, somewhat of a different matter. But the evidence from shorelines, from mineralogy, from... gullies that they're seeing at crater walls, it's almost overwhelming at this point that there was liquid water on Mars at one point in its history. It could have been a very long time ago. It's certainly been the planet doesn't have enough atmosphere to support liquid water at this point. Can't do it.
And nobody knows how long ago it was that the water
was
there?
The chronology of Mars is not well known. We have not been able to get... rock from particular regions where we know where they came from. There are Mars rocks on Earth. We can do radioactive dating of those, but we don't know where they came from, and that renders it relatively useless. We need to do what we did with the moon, either send a craft there or somebody there to bring stuff back, samples from all over the planet, and then we begin to get a chronology. We've got a good chronology of the moon, but not of Mars. It's pretty shaky within a billion years or so. It's not good.
Yeah. Do you? I'm just curious. Do you think? And now there's been a lot. Obviously, there's always going to be controversy about planetary missions and how much they're going to cost and whether we're going to do that. And the president sometime back said, "Yes, well, let's do it. Let's say we're going to moon. Well, we're going to Mars."
It pops up every once in a while. I'm sorry that we didn't maintain lunar missions. We can easily get to the moon and back. We did it in the 60s. 70s. It wasn't hard. It was hard, yeah, but we could do it, and we proved we could do it safely. If that had been extended, we'd have had a nice lunar base at this point and been able to go back and forth, both for scientific reasons, for maybe even technological reasons. But we didn't. And the first step, I think, now this is my personal opinion, the first step is not even to look at Mars at this point. We get back to the moon first and then see where we go from there. The leap from here to moon compared to here to Mars is stupendous. In terms of human safety, in terms of cost, you get fooled. You look up in the sky, and there's Mars right next to the moon. How hard can it be? Well, I mean, one is a gazillion, to be technical, a lot of times farther away than the other one. And we simply, to my knowledge, have no capability whatever of putting a human being in space for the protracted months or year it would take to actually explore the planet. I presume at some point we will indeed go. But it'll, I think, be a sort of a natural outcome of search and discovery rather than just say, oh, let's go, and we go. It's not that simple.
the conditions on Mars, are they any more difficult than conditions on the moon?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Supporting human life.
No, I mean, you guys do have an atmosphere after all. I can't tell you how protective it is, not terribly. The solar wind pounds down onto the surface or very close to it because Mars has a pathetic magnetic field, if any at all. And so you're really not protected very well on the planet. So in that sense, it's kind of lunar-like. It's a dangerous place to be for a lot of reasons.
Mm. But the big challenge is the distance?
I would say, yeah. You're out in space for a long time getting there in a very harsh environment.
Yeah. And I suppose once you go to the trouble of going all that way, you're not going to go for an hour and then turn around
and
come back.
No, you're going to have to go there, and you're going to have to explore there. So you've got to have life support for months and months. This is totally beyond anything we've ever done before. Mm-hmm. You can't send another spacecraft out to rescue. The list of difficulties, and I don't mean to be negative. I'd like to see us go, but sometime in the future. But from my point of view, let's do it by getting back to the moon first with some kind of logical plan as to why we want to get there and what we're going to do with it. And then we can look at going to Mars.
Mm-hmm. What are the other than doing it, other than the kinds of things that we would learn about humans living in space for a long period of time? Do we get out of going to the...
There was an op-ed article in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, about the lack of need to go to Mars. Let's explore our planet first point of view. And the fact is that by going to Mars, whether you do it with human or robotic craft, you are exploring our planet by going to another one. You learn something about us by looking at the others. All the other planets in the solar system are natural experiments, mm-hmm. and under different conditions. We learned a lot about the Earth by looking at the moon, for example. And you can't help but look. If you want to understand the Earth, you got to look at the whole solar system, the whole planetary system, because everything is interacting with everything else over the long scale. We're getting pounded constantly, hundreds of times a day, for example, by meteorites from the asteroid belt. We're in that environment. You're not isolated. So terrestrial exploration, there's an aspect of exploring the Earth that goes to exploring the planets. And I think it's a wonderful idea. We can do a lot by robotic craft, and I think eventually we're going to go there. I think just to make the sudden leap over a couple of decades is prohibitively costly, mm-hmm. and without a real solid plan at this point.
Well, I think for this time around, we'll say thanks for being here.
You're very welcome.
In the meantime, if you're interested, and you have access to the Internet, there's lots of stuff about astronomy there, but one place that you might go would be to the U of I Astronomy Department website, www.astro.uiuc.edu.
That's right.
And there you can click on some links to various other kinds of sources of information, and then there is it Skylights?
Skylights.
Skylights.
Right, right.
Little column there that Jim writes that talks about what you can see in the sky various times of the year.
Updated every Friday, along with the star of the week.
Right.
Hopeless new star every week.
And you also might look, if you want to do some reading about stars, you might look for a couple of Jim's books. One, The Little Book of Stars, and the other is The Greatest 100 Stars. At a bookstore near you.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Jim Kaler, he's a professor of astronomy here at U of I, and with us occasionally on the show to talk about what you can see in the sky various times of the year.